the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network presents Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis. Each week, Joan brings you news from inside the Vatican and the Church around the world, as well as interviews and answers to your questions. Now, here's the host of Vatican Insider, Joan Lewis.
Welcome to Vatican Insider on this Palm Sunday weekend and the start of Holy Week. I'll get to the news segment in a minute, but first want to tell you about the special I've prepared for the interview segment entitled, Who is the Man of the Shroud? For decades, as worshipers gather around the world to commemorate Christ's passion, death, and resurrection, scientists have been studying the results of tests made on an object alleged to be directly connected to that passion. The object of intense religious devotion, as well as scientific curiosity, is a simple strip of linen known as the Shroud of Turin. It's been venerated by Christians for centuries as the burial cloth that wrapped the body of Jesus Christ in his tomb after his crucifixion and death. I explore the provenance and history of that relic, as well as the scientific tests that have been done over the years in order to find an answer to the question, who is the man of the shroud? And now the news highlights of the past week. Sunday, March 17th, at the Angelus, after reflecting on the Gospel for the fifth Sunday of Lent, Pope Francis expressed his relief over the freeing, days earlier, of a teacher and four of six brothers of the Sacred Heart following their kidnapping in Haiti on February the 23rd. Two remain in captivity, and the Pope appealed for their release as soon as possible, as well as for all those still held in the beloved country so fraught with violence. Francis also asked for prayers for the war-torn populations of Ukraine, Palestine and Israel, and South Sudan. And he recalled the people of Syria, asking that we not forget their plight, as the nation there has suffered greatly for a long time because of war. Monday, March 18th, at 3 in the afternoon at the Altar of the Chair in St. Peter's Basilica, the Holy Father delivered the final commendation and farewell at the funeral of German-born Cardinal Paul Cordes, former head of the Pontifical Council Cor Unum. He died March 15th. Tuesday, March 19th, Solemnity of St. Joseph. Pope Francis released his message for the 61st World Day of Prayer for Vocations, to be celebrated on April the 21st. He urges Christians to welcome our shared vocation to sow the seeds of hope and peace in our world, and to welcome our God-given vocation to serve Him in the world, whether it be through the consecrated life, the priesthood, marriage, or even as a single person. He especially invited young people to make room for God so that they might find happiness in His call, which always respects our freedom. Let Jesus draw you to Himself, said the Pope. Bring Him your important questions by reading the Gospels. Let Him challenge you by His presence, which always provokes in us a healthy crisis. Also Tuesday, Pope Francis offered words of encouragement and expressed the closeness of the Church to family farmers in a message he sent to participants at the 8th Global Conference of the World Rural Forum taking place in Basque Country, Spain. The conference focused on family farming, sustainability of our planet, and common efforts to eradicate hunger, reduce inequality, and promote stewardship of our planet. Also Tuesday, on the 30th anniversary of the assassination of Father Giuseppe Diana at the hands of the Neapolitan Mafia, Pope Francis, in a letter to Bishop Angelo Spinillo of Aversa, urged especially young people to take up the priest's legacy of fighting against organized crime and not to let themselves be robbed of hope. Wednesday, March 20th. The general audience in St. Peter's Square continued the papal catechesis on virtues, with a priest from the Secretariat of State reading the papal speech for Francis. The focus was on prudence, one of the four cardinal virtues that, together with the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, are the pillars of integrated Christian living. Prudence, said the papal talk, is the ability to combine intelligence and creativity, simplicity and shrewdness. It is understanding the complexity of situations and evaluating possible solutions. Also Wednesday, March 20th, the Holy Father sent a message to bishops from the border of Colombia and Costa Rica and the bishops of Panama, who had been in Panama for an encounter entitled Easter with Our Migrant Brothers and Sisters, focused on the church's pastoral outreach to the hundreds of thousands of migrants who attempt to cross the treacherous Darien Gap that connects Central and South America. Francis urged the bishops to, quote, eradicate the indifference towards migrants and refugees passing through the Darien Gap. Also Wednesday, with the Kirograph, Pope Francis approved new statutes and regulations for the chapter of the Papal Basilica of St. Mary Major, appointing Lithuanian-born Archbishop Rolandas Makrikas as the new coadjutor archpriest and focusing the basilica's canons on pastoral and spiritual duties. Thursday, March 21st, Pope Francis had a private audience with Maltese President George Vela, who gave the Pope 6 computers for the Mother of Mercy Clinic that serves the poor in St. Peter's Square. Also Thursday, in a letter to a group of migrants gathered in Lajas Blancas, Panama, the Pope said he wanted to accompany them personally, saying, I too am a child of migrants who set out in search of a better future. Pope Francis thanked the bishops and pastoral workers who care for them and said they represent the face of a mother church who walks with her sons and daughters. Migrants, he said, represent the suffering body of Christ when they are forced to leave their country to face the risks and tribulations of a difficult journey when they find no other way out. Also Thursday, the decades-long case of 87-year-old Belgian Bishop Roger van Gerluwe, who was found guilty of sexual abuse of minors, has ended with his dismissal from the clerical state. Pope Francis approved the sentence following a re-examination of the case in light of, quote, serious new elements reported to the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. Friday, March 22nd, the Pope and ranking members of the Roman Curia attended the 5th and final Lenten sermon given by Cardinal Raniero Cantalamessa, preacher of the papal household in the Paul VI Hall. He reflected on Jesus' words, I am the resurrection and the life. Also Friday, the Holy Father met with the bishops of the Italian region of Lazio on their ad limina visit. Well, those are the week's news highlights, but now stay here for part one of my special, Who is the Man of the Shroud?
This is Dale Alquist. When G.K. Chesterton was asked why he became Catholic, he said, to get rid of my sins. Only the Catholic Church can do that. He said that when a man steps out of the confessional, he's 5 minutes old and his whole life has just started over again. When we confess our sins, our souls are wiped clean. We get to start all over again.
This is Jim Pinto, Director of EWTN Media Missionaries. EWTN Media Missionaries prayerfully take EWTN to parishes and the community through the print and electronic media we provide. You can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.
For more than 25 years, Mother Angelica and many others have shared their stories of spiritual conversion on The Journey Home. Mother hoped these powerful testimonies would inspire cradle Catholics and converts alike to explore the faith. Guideposts for The Journey Home, Conversion Stories with Marcus Grodi, features some of the program's most popular guests who give answers to real-life questions posed directly by the viewers. In these pages, Father Benedict Groeschel and Mother Angelica recount their vocational journeys, while famed convert Scott Hahn shares why he found himself and his family on the road to Rome, and more. Guideposts for the Journey Home, Conversion Stories with Marcus Grody, the latest release from EWTN Publishing, now available at EWTNRC.com or call 1-800-854-6316.
Why do we need to pray? We don't pray because God needs our prayers. We pray because we need God's grace. And every day when I face the day, I realize I have no idea what I'm doing. And I need God to walk me through my day, step by step, giving me the grace, the counsel, the love, the encouragement that enables me to glorify Him in everything that I do and become the person He wants me to be. Prayer is my lifeline.
Welcome back to Vatican Insider. Here's Joan Lewis.
Who is the man of the Shroud of Turin? Can we even answer that question? As you know, the mystery of the death and resurrection of Christ is celebrated every year throughout the Christian world during Holy Week. What you may not know is that as worshipers gather to commemorate Christ's passion, scientists have been studying the results of tests made on an object alleged to be directly associated with that passion. The object of intense religious devotion, as well as scientific curiosity, is a simple strip of linen known as the Shroud of Turin. It has been venerated by Christians for centuries as the burial cloth that wrapped the body of Jesus Christ in his tomb after his crucifixion and death. The 2015 exposition of the Shroud was only the eighth time since 1900 that it has been made available to the public. It was displayed in 1931 for the wedding of Prince Umberto of Savoy with Maria Jose of Belgium. The House of Savoy was the owner of the Shroud for many centuries, but has since given it to the Vatican. The Shroud was displayed again in 1933 to mark the holy year called to mark the 19th centenary of the Passion and Death of Christ. In 1973, the world had its first televised showing of the Shroud. In 1978, it was again shown to mark the fourth century of its transfer to Turin from Chambéry in France. Three more showings occurred before the 2015 exposition. One in 1998 recalled the centenary of the first photograph of the Shroud by lawyer Secondo Pia in 1898, and also the fifth centenary of the Turin Cathedral. Another took place at the Great Jubilee year 2000, and again an exposition in 2010. The 1978 43-day exposition marked only the fifth time in the last 100 years that this relic of Christianity had received public exposure, and it marked an even rarer occasion for direct access to scientific study. After the public exposition, the Shroud was turned over to scientists for brief study in an attempt to clear up centuries of mystery surrounding the cloth. While scientific research has told us much, it does not solve what may forever remain the greatest mystery. Was this Christ's burial cloth? The pure linen cloth of Middle Eastern origin is a simple opaque tissue of fishbone weave, measuring 14 by 3.5 feet. It contains the full-length frontal and dorsal imprints of a man and has carmine-colored stains corresponding to blood. It is spangled with a double series of dark spots caused by burns it underwent in a fire in the 16th century, and the water used to douse the fire left broad symmetrical rings clearly visible. Less visible but seen upon close observation are transverse marks corresponding to the creases of the linen that before its final voyage to Turin in 1578 had been preserved in its reliquary by folding it in 48 thicknesses. Because the Santa Sindone, the Holy Shroud, lacked fully documented evidence of its provenance prior to surfacing in France in the 14th century, it was assumed that the images had at some point been painted on the linen cloth. In the Middle Ages, controversies arose as to the authenticity of these images, and accusations of falsification were prevalent. Proofs were lacking for both sides of the argument, and the relic slipped into relative obscurity. However, in 1898, during an 8-day exposition of the Shroud, a lawyer and dilettante photographer from Turin, Secondo Pia, who had been commissioned to photograph the Shroud by its legal owner, King Umberto I of the House of Savoy, astounded the world with the results of his photographs and reopened the case for the authenticity of the Shroud. The original imprints of the man on the linen are a form of the negative in themselves, and thus photographing them produces a negative of a negative, with the result being a startling positive of the subject. The bloodstains and burn marks, however, distinctly impregnated in the material, follow photographic inversion principles and are dark on the original and light on the negative. Photography was then in an embryonic state, but Pia's amateur black and white photographs revealed the dimension of the shroud heretofore never seen and stimulated the imagination of scientists, archaeologists, photographers, theologians, and doctors. At that moment, a multiple study of the famous linen began that continues to the present. Paul Claudel, the eminent French writer, said, "The photographic discovery is of such importance, I do not hesitate to compare it to a second resurrection." And so, since 1898, dozens of other prominent men of all walks of life, stimulated by scientific motives, intellectual curiosity, or principles of faith, have devoted much of their lives to the study of this, quote, document written in blood. One acknowledged expert in the field of syndonology, or study of the shroud, was Monsignor Giulio Ricci, at one time president of the Rome Center for Syndonology, who in his 28 years of personal devoted study to the shroud, and in close collaboration with scientists, archaeologists, and theologians, contributed immensely to what we know today about the shroud and the man of the shroud. When we first met several decades ago, two life-size transparencies, possessing a third-dimensional effect, occupied part of his office, and he traced inch by inch the anatomical details and individual markings of the shroud and explained their significance. Both he and the shroud told a most wonderful story. I first saw the real shroud in Turin during the 2010 exposition. By far the most outstanding, almost startling aspect of the shroud are the bodily imprints. They reveal the athletic and physically harmonious body of an adult male, approximately 5'6" tall. The longish hair, beard, and mustache seem well cured, and his face bears a look of almost serene majesty. Closer scrutiny evidences the correctness of certain anatomical particulars. The conventional differences in symmetry, for example, between the right and left sides of a person, and the 1-to-8 ratio in normal head-to-body proportions. These are considered as partial proof for the authenticity of the shroud, as these only fairly recently discovered details could not possibly have been known to an artist forger 6 centuries ago. The late Monsignor Ricci claimed when we spoke that the man of the shroud was 5'6" tall, basing this on archaeological proof of the average height of a Palestinian 2,000 years ago, as well as close studies made of the folds in the shroud. He concluded that the exceptional height that some would wish to attribute to Jesus with a surface glance of the shroud's imprints can be accounted for by numerous folds in the cloth. Exaggerated lengths of certain parts of the anatomy, most notably the right forearm and hand and the anterior print of the tibia, were due to the fact that the linen was folded at these points. The bodily imprints revealed themselves throughout the thicknesses of the folds, so that when the shroud was unfolded to its full length, the images appear in full but unnaturally prolongated. By subtracting the amount of material used in folding, as revealed by the crease marks on the shroud, the natural height results in 5'6". Now, the body was laid in the lower half of the rectangular cloth with the feet toward the open end. The linen was then folded at the head and laid over the frontal portion of his body until it met at his feet, where it was tucked under. Though the burial was hasty, the transverse lines of the cloth indicate it was folded under his chin, beneath his forearms, around the femur, and wrapped both feet. Although impressive, the bodily imprints do not tell the story of the passion and death of this man as vividly as do the carmine color stains. Indicating the rivulets of blood on the back head and forehead, Monsignor Ricci told me that the head had been entirely covered with a helmet and not the traditional crown of sharp thorns, piercing the delicate vascular surface and thus causing numerous wounds and great blood loss. He underscored the fact that throughout oral tradition and written history, the only mention ever made of a crucified man being crowned with thorns is the biblical account of the crucifixion of Christ. Further bloodstains on the arms, back, shoulders, and legs, and the study of their intensity and directional flow, tell the story of a man who had been flagellated, bound by both wrists and ankles, had borne an enormous weight on his shoulders, causing the bruised skin to tear and bleed, and whose wrist, feet, and right side were pierced through by sharp instruments. Though death by crucifixion was common in the days of Christ, a most singular element manifests itself both in the biblical account of Christ's death and on the shroud's imprints. To either hasten or ensure death, a final touch was always added to the crucifixion. The victim's legs were broken. In the case of Christ, however, this was not done, as the Gospels tell us. Instead, his side was pierced with a lance, as evidenced on the shroud by a complex of stains of deep red blood surrounded by a lighter serous liquid. It was, in fact, the scrutiny of the shroud's bloodstains, using the most sophisticated techniques and comparing the results with the biblical accounts of the death of Jesus, that convinced Monsignor Ricci and others that this was indeed the burial linen of Christ. The stains corroborate in a decisive manner the exegetical account of Christ's ordeal on Calvary. In addition, they support the biochemical laws of blood coagulation and the process of hemolysis and fibrinolysis, by which, within a given time span, blood is transferred onto a fabric when the fibrin, a white insoluble protein formed in the process of clotting, is half dissolved neither before nor after. Too few hours of contact with the body would have prevented bloodstains from appearing. Too many hours of contact through excessive softening of the fibrin would have blurred the stains. Instead, the shroud presents bloodstains in perfect harmony with the laws of coagulation and with the precise time frame for transferring via hemolysis and fibrinolysis, a scientifically demonstrated period of 36 hours, which would correspond to the approximately 36 hours Jesus remained in the sepulcher between burial and his resurrection that first Easter Sunday. Experiments in this area have also been made by Professor Baima Bolone, a leading forensic expert, and Dr. Sebastiano Rodante, a pediatrician, and the results were published early in 1978. Their tests proved unquestionably that the presence of both aloes and myrrh on a fabric aided in bringing about the process of hemolysis and fibrinolysis. In the case of the shroud, the transfer of the bloodstains. Dozens more studies have been published in the intervening years by these men and many others. Monsignor Ricci, summarizing the shroud's distinct bloody testimony to the physical passion of the man of the shroud, excludes completely the theory that this linen is the result of a forger's brush, and the latest scientific evidence does not contradict this statement. The shroud is not a document of faith, he told me. It's a document of scientific research. It was necessary to go back and restudy biblical, apocryphal, patristic, archaeological, and historical sources, Jewish and Roman law, as well as that of other Middle Eastern peoples. Above all, it was necessary to undertake an accurate geometric and medico-legal examination of the imprints. Now, these multiple aspects of research into the problem of authenticity and identification of the man of the shroud posed a formidable challenge involving many nations. Foremost among these problems for syndonologists, scholars of the shroud, was determining its provenance and its odyssey, concluding with its final resting place in the Guarini Chapel of St. John's Cathedral in Turin. Exact and detailed documentation of the shroud's history in the centuries immediately following the death of Christ is wanting due to historical and even juridical factors. The troubled history of Jerusalem in that period, the lack of freedom and expression enjoyed by Christians in that part of the world, and even the Jewish law that considered as unclean anything having to do with death, so that any violation of the tomb, such as taking of a shroud, even for a relic, was punishable by death. Thus, in this obscure period when the shroud's history seems untraceable, these voids in its odyssey can be accounted for if one considers the fear of contamination with death-related objects by the Jews, the hostility to the new Christians, and the onslaught of invasions and sacking by Vandals. So that, had the precious relic been preserved by Jesus' disciples, it would have been kept well hidden until safer conditions made it possible to openly expose and venerate the sacred object. In the first centuries after Christ, frequent indirect references to this burial linen were made, and only in the post-Constantine period was it named explicitly and displayed openly. Historical testimonials place it in Jerusalem prior to the 11th century. Towards 1005, it was transferred to Constantinople, and chronicles a century later ascribed to its presence there when they recorded that Louis VII of France, on an official visit to that city in 1147, venerated the Holy Shroud. They also tell us that only 10 years later, in 1157, Abbot Nicholas Samuelsson, while making an inventory of the relics in Constantinople, included the Holy Shroud on his list. The first clear references to its presence there, in the monastery of St. Mary of Blakeney, were made by Robert de Clary, a knight from Picardy, who took part in the capture of Constantinople in 1204. As a spoil of war, the shroud was taken to France and kept first at Liray, where contemporary chronicles explicitly mention its regular expositions there. Its owner, Marguerite de Charny, made a gift of it in 1452 to the Duke of Savoy in Chambéry, where it remained until its transfer to Turin in 1578. It was in the chapel specifically built for the shroud by the Duke of Savoy that a fire broke out in 1532, and this relic was partially damaged when the heat caused the molten silver of the reliquary to penetrate and burn the fine linen. Nuns were ordered to repair the cloth, and their stitch work could be seen for years. Now, this fire and subsequent repair work has a very important bearing on experiments that have been done to indicate the shroud's age. Well, that's all the time we have today to talk about the famed Shroud of Turin, believed, as I said, to be the linen cloth that wrapped the body of the crucified Jesus during his 3 days in the tomb. Join me next week for part two, a final look at the shroud. Can we answer the question, who is the man of the shroud?
For more information on these stories, or to check out Joan's blog and to ask her a question, go to EWTN.com. That's EWTN.com. Thanks for listening to Vatican Insider on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.